I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
It's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again. You've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
But we ain't killing they army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, Ben, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, introducing the great Sheldon Richmond, my partner at the Libertarian Institute, and great author of thousands and thousands of great libertarian articles going back for many years. The very latest is, are we sure it can't happen here? Welcome back to the show, Sheldon. How are you doing? I think it might be happening, man.
I'm doing great, Scott. You are the best at reading headlines with expression. Wow. That's one of your many, many skills, but it's a talent. It's a definite talent. You do it with a lot of people.
There you go. Oh, do I? Yeah, I guess I try. You know, do what you can. Hey, great article, but let's not talk about it yet. Let's instead talk about what you wrote about previously, which sounds, you know, it's a little bit arcane, but it's so important about who's adopting what definition of anti-Semitism and the effect that that has on debates over Israel and Palestine on American college campuses. And there's been a major development in that story, so I won't be any more specific from that. You go ahead and explain.
Yeah, was it last week or the week before? I lose track. I did an article, a follow-up to what I had been doing about this, in the American context, the pending before Congress, Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, which is in the committees of the House and Senate, which would direct the Department of Education, the Office of Civil Rights there, to adopt more or less a what's now being regarded as the official definition plus description of anti-Semitism that was embraced by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, which the U.S. is a member of, and which originally originated in the America with the American Jewish Committee. They and the Wiesenthal Center pushed various groups to adopt this, and it was also the matter of controversy in Great Britain with the Labour Party, because when they when their executive committee got into this issue of what constitutes anti-Semitism, they didn't go all the way. They didn't adopt all these alleged examples of anti-Semitism in that, quote, official definition. When I say official, you know, just remember the quotation marks around it. And then they got accused of being anti-Semitic, and Jeremy Corbyn, who's the head of the party and possible future prime minister, has been smeared as an anti-Semite, and they backed down, and now they've embraced the entire thing. So I warned in the last article I did about this and I'm not the first to do this. I was one of the last to warn about Kenneth Marcus, who was confirmed in June as Trump's assistant secretary of education for civil rights, which means he runs the Office of Civil Rights. Now, he has a history in the private sector. He set up and ran an independent nonprofit organization called the Brandeis Center for Human Rights and Law, conflating, as I say, anti-Semitism with criticism of Israel, what he calls anti-Israelism. He says there's no difference really between anti-Semitism and anti-Israelism, or we might call anti-Zionism. So he now is the head of that office, who would be the one enforcing on the colleges and universities this definition. I guess what none of us actually foresaw is that he doesn't need the law to pass. he's now proclaimed that this is he's going to operate on the basis of this definition and examples. He doesn't need the bill doesn't have to come out of committee and pass the two Congresses as long as he's running the office. Now, it's true that if a new president is elected in 2020 and someone else is put in charge of that office, he wouldn't have to that new secretary wouldn't have to be using the definition. But for the time being, certainly until the end of 2020, that is the reigning definition plus examples. So what he did and how did he do this? He announced this without putting it out for public comment or anything of that sort, just announced this, that he's reviving a 2011 case from Rutgers University, which didn't get anywhere. But the complaint was made to the Office of Civil Rights, because 2011 means Obama years, a complaint was made to the Office of Civil Rights that Jewish students Jewish students were discriminated against at an event held on the campus by an outside group, but nevertheless they rented facilities on the campus for an event. Ironically enough, was called Never Again for Anybody. It included Palestinians and Holocaust survivors. In other words, it was a joint, it seems to me, a nice conciliatory event talking about the dangers that can befall any people, and as it did to the Jews in Europe and then especially under the Nazis, and then as it has to the Palestinians. So it was an ecumenical meeting. But it was descended upon by a large group of pro-Israel students, and I think non-students, because the word had gone out, according to all the reporting, a local synagogue near Rutgers put out the word to organizations that it's linked to, involved in, saying, descend on this meeting. There were reports from people on the side of the organization that was putting this on that there was a hostility and even intimidation by students. And one of the emails that somehow the Zionist organization got a hold of made a reference to 150 pro-Zionist students. And so that was seized on by the ZOA to say, see, this that's a code word for Jewish. So that by the definition under these IHRA definition, which has been embraced by the State Department, even under Obama, that constitutes anti-Semitism and therefore a hostile atmosphere to the Jewish students of Rutgers and therefore actionable by the Office of Civil Rights of the Department of Education under the 1964 Civil Rights Act. That's how it all connects legally. So there was an investigation, again, back in 2011 and beyond, and they couldn't find any evidence. There was a specific charge that only Jewish students were charged admittance fees to this meeting. There was apparently no evidence for that. There was no finding, both by Rutgers and by the OCR. And they just dismissed it. For lack of evidence. Burdens, obviously, on the burden of proof is on the side of the one making the allegation, and they didn't sustain the burden. Mm. The ZOA wanted to appeal it, but that it kind of died. Marcus now has revived it. He's saying, okay, I'll hear the appeal. And he, of course, is on the record for many years now of claiming that any anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. And he even said in this in his letter to the ZOA announcing what he was doing, he said, we need to determine whether that in that email, the word Zionist students was code word for Jewish students. So one thing that immediately struck me is conservatives and, to the extent that conservatives support this sort of thing. And of course, mainline conservatives do, it seems to me. I'm not talking about the alt-right, but certainly sort of regular conservatives and Trump fans, a lot of Trump fans, they used to hate the Department of Education and the Office of Civil Rights and the idea of a thought police. Now they've embraced all three in this context only, though, because they like that there's the DOE now, they like that there's an OCR with Marcus at the head of it, and he's going to somehow divine whether when somebody says Zionist, he means Jew. How's he going to do that? He's going to have a seance or some sort of spiritual or mind reading session, or put him up on some machine lie detector to figure out what is it they quote mean when they say that. That sounds like thought police. And how is that not squelching freedom of speech and free inquiry on campuses, which many, many civil libertarians have been warning about, including, by the way, the author of this definition and plus examples, Kenneth Stern, another Kenneth Stern, not to be confused with Kenneth Marcus, has warned and told Congress, don't pass this because it will chill free speech. And that's not what I meant when I came up with this notion of anti-Semitism. It wasn't meant for the purpose of policing free speech on campuses or anywhere. Mm-hmm. So lots of heavy-hitting people have warned that this should not be used and should not be put into law, and they're appalled that Marcus is doing this, but he's doing it. Mm-hmm. And predictably, you know, there's nothing surprising. It should have been predictable that he would take it on his own initiative rather than wait for the law to be passed.
Well, I like the part about, well, it's the State Department definition, which is just like Dick Cheney going on Meet the Press and citing a Judy Miller story that he put in the New York Times and saying, see, even the New York Times says, laundering this bias through some other institution for a minute, to lend it some credibility there. But so let me make sure I understand the story here with the Rutgers case. Basically, it was dismissed, but I guess, do I have it right? Maybe I don't have it right. That the jurisdiction here, it doesn't really apply if there was an anti-religious bias. They have to redefine Judaism as an ethnicity so that they can investigate it as a basis of like a racism charge under the civil rights policy.
I explained this in the original article I wrote on this for a few weeks ago. People can look it up. I explain what's going on there. If you look at Title VI of the that's the relevant title of this of 64 Act. It doesn't mention religion. It talks about discrimination on the basis of race, ethnic, national origin, or ethnicity. I think that's it. So there's no reference to religion. So what the DOE under Obama did, and this goes back to Obama, what the Department of Education originally did was put out a letter, what's called a Dear Colleague letter to state and local education agencies, departments of local government, state governments, and said, we are, in effect, there's my words now, we're reinterpreting Title VI because in some cases that look like religious discrimination, the discrimination may be, and they always do maybes, could be really a reference to the person, the targets, the victims, ethnicity, or national origin or race. So in that way, they got in, they could get anti-Semitism into it. They also named Sikhs and Muslims. They say they also, so in other words, anti-Muslim activity would also be interpreted as, okay, that's anti-Arab or, it could be anti-Persian, I guess. So it was a way to break out of this confinement. Since it didn't mention religion, they found a way to bring religion in. Like, oh, well, often the practitioners of these religions have something in common by race or ancestry or ethnicity, national origin. So therefore, it comes under Title VI. A bit of a stretch, but
Well, and of course, I don't know. Anyway, I mean, the whole thing is so obviously bogus. The question is, can anybody try to stop them? I mean, if they were doing this about, okay, well, you can't criticize Chinese relations with Mongolia, otherwise you're a racist and you hate Chinese people or some kind of thing like that, would we have patience for that? And we would say, oh, okay, you're right, I guess we can't criticize the Han for dominating the Tibetans anymore either, because now that, maybe that's a better example since one people care about,
Kenneth Stern, the lead author of this definition plus examples. I don't want to call it just a definition because they distinguish the definition, which is like 38 words and really is meaningless, from a bunch of specific definitions. 7 of 11 refer to Israel, not about discriminating against or hating Jews, qua Jews, but just, saying something negative about the state of Israel. That's what's gotten, so much of our side of things, my side of things, certainly upset. So Stern says, imagine if someone opposes Palestinian self-determination, which plenty of pro-Israel people do, then doesn't that make them anti-Palestinianism? And so why isn't that racism? And why isn't that condemned on campus? And now, what, wasn't Marcus going after anybody that wants to put down voices? And this has been happening for years. Marcus is one of the people involved in this. It's been happening at San Francisco State University and lots of other places. Why isn't that racist? If you're trying to squelch, go after people who are defending the right of the Palestinians to self-determination, if to oppose Jewish self-determination is anti-Semitic, then there's something racist or even anti-Semitic about opposing Palestinian self-determination.
Right. After and, all, of course, that makes a lot more sense, actually, not in favor of any censorship. But, you know, of course Zionism is based on racism against Palestinians because it's all about justifying depriving them of their rights. So, you know, who's got the power? Who's occupying who here? You don't. You wouldn't have to be anti-Semitic at all, anti-Jewish at all, to say that they should stop violating other people's rights. The Israelis should stop violating other people's rights. But to justify violating the Palestinians' rights, yeah, racism is a huge component in that. You know, it, another part of it, of course, is how they always talk about the Palestinians as though they're all Muslims because they don't want to talk about the fifth of them that are Christians and how... You know, because that's the kind of thing that Americans actually might, you know, pique their curiosity that, you know, oh, I didn't realize that there were people who believe the same as me that are on the side of, you know, who are oppressed along with the Muslims rather than being on the side of the Jewish majority state there.
That's right. Yeah. And it's funny because when, you know, this idea of denying or claim, you know, saying that Jews don't have the right of self-determination, that's regarded as a, you know, that it's going to sound like Jeff Foxworthy now. This is the point I was going to bring up. The position is if you take that position that the Jews don't have the right of self-determination, you may be not a redneck, but a anti-Semite. That's one of their chief examples, right? Denying that Jews have a right to self-determination. But as I've said in a couple different places, I don't know anybody, I'm not talking about some fringe, you know, David Duke or something. I don't know anybody who says Jews don't have the right of self-determination. What they say is, and that's only half of the sentence, they don't have the right of self-determination on other people's land, on stolen land. Let's say that and talk about it. Instead, it's just left that they don't have the right to self-determination. Look, if a group of Jewish people, observant or not, they can call themselves whatever they want. If they buy land anywhere in the world legitimately and don't, you know, kick off the rightful owners and set up, you know, in effect, a kibbutz or a country club or whatever they want to call it and say we're a state and we're all Jewish, so it's a Jewish state. Fine. They can do that. That's self-determination. They shouldn't be stopped. I don't doesn't mean I'm going to move there. But they shouldn't be stopped. The objection is to kicking up Palestinians off their land, and it can be easily demonstrated that it was the land of individual Palestinians and towns and villages. They kicked them off and then said, this is our nation. We now have self-determination. That's the objection. But people always like leave off the second part of it. And then they say, see, if you're denying that Jews have a right of self-determination, you must be an anti-Semite.
Yeah, well, and I guess part of, you know, the irony of the whole thing, right, is the more transparent this is, the more necessary it is. And we can't just have people going around explaining the Palestinian side of the story here. We've got to clamp down on that because it does not favor Israel at all to even describe the basic facts of who's occupying who over there. They constantly pretend like Palestine is already an independent state that's constantly at war with Israel and victimizing Israel and trying to extort land away from Israel. You know, the whole thing is completely upside down. And once people get a grip on who's occupying what, then they change their mind pretty quickly about. That's certainly my experience.
Well, right, because most people don't know the story. But what you just said is not controversial among historians and others who look carefully into this. And I don't just mean partisans, you know, sort of critics of Israel. In the late 80s, when the government documents, archives were finally opened up after a certain number of years, about 1948, the War of Independence and all that stuff, and the violence beforehand by the Irgun and, the, you know, pre-Israel Zionist militias, Jewish Israeli historians across the spectrum went into the documents and wrote books. The books poured out in the late 80s and beyond, still coming out, pointing out that it's not controversial. There was ethnic cleansing. Benny Morris, probably, you know, perhaps the most prominent, is pro-Israel, thinks it was the right thing to do. Without the ethnic cleansing, he says, Israel couldn't have been established. And he says that would have been, you know, and that's too, that would have been too bad. And he compares it to the U.S., you know, wiping out the Indians, because he says there wouldn't have been America if the Indians hadn't been wiped out. And of course, we all realize it's good that America was founded. So he draws a parallel there. The only debate that he's still fighting, and lots of people have shown he hasn't made his case, is whether, you know, how premeditated the ethnic cleansing was, or whether it all just came up as a wartime contingency. But he's not sustained his case. That's been critiqued by Norman Finkelstein and Ilan Pappe and many other people to show there was a plan. It was known as Plan Dalit, Plan D. About, you know, this was in the plan. But even Morris, who wants to deny that this was premeditated, says the following in his book, I believe it's called Righteous Victims, that dispossession and displacement of the Palestinians was inherent in Zionism, inevitable and inherent in Zionism. In other words, if you're going to have a Jewish state, you got to have a Jewish majority, and preferably a supermajority, unless it's totally unanimous, all Jewish. And they couldn't do that in Palestine the way it was populated in 1948. There were the Arabs, Christians, like you say, Christians and Muslims, Arabs outnumbered Jews from no matter where. And therefore, if you're going to have, quote, a Jewish state, whatever that means exactly, but if you're going to have a Jewish state, the Jews can't be a minority in that state. And this was the thinking of the people trying to build the state of Israel. So they said, we have to get rid of them. This was said from the beginning by Herzl. They used the word transfer, the nicer word transfer. And Herzl, it's a quote that's been quoted many, many times, totally famous, about how we have to spirit the penniless population across the border, you know, deposit them across the border. He says something like, help them secure employment, but deny them employment here, meaning in Palestine, in which is now going to be run by the Jews. Everybody knows that was the idea. You couldn't have had it otherwise. The UN tried to gerrymander it to get a slight majority of Jews in the, you know, in the part of the Jewish part of the partition it was going to recommend, but it was very unstable and ended up with two states that were very odd shapes and, you know, not viable, and it was a mess. And the Zionists accepted it, knowing, oh, don't worry, we won't have to live with this. We'll cease the rest of it in our own good time.
Yeah,
which they pretty much have done.
Hey, by the way, everybody's got to read Obstacle to Peace, The U.S. Role in the Israel-Palestinian Conflict, or Israel-Palestine Conflict by Jeremy Hammond. It's great. I'm almost done with it. And then I imagine that's going to be like a 2 or 3 hour interview or something. Yeah, it's just the most meticulous thing in the world. Have you read that?
I don't think, I confused it with a couple of the titles. Is this the latest of his books?
No, I don't think so. I think it's a few years old, 2 or 3 or 4 years old or something.
Maybe the one I read.
It's the one that's got got the most severe rundown of Cass Led in 2008 and 2009, and of the Mavi Marmara attack and all that.
He's an indefatigable researcher on this subject. His stuff is great. It's not the only thing he's written. People can find other things of his. He's got a little institute. It was called Foreign Policy Institute or something.
And Foreign Policy Journal.
He's got a very good piece on the myth of the UN creation of Israel, which is completely misunderstood by people.
Right.
The UN has no power under its laws to create a nation or to divide a country. So all that the General Assembly did in 1947 was recommend that the Security Council, look at this idea. I mean, that's all it could do. And it passed. Both Russia and the United States voted for it. But it didn't create Israel. Israel created Israel. Because less than a year later, seven months later, Ben-Gurion declared independence. They said, we are now a state. So the UN didn't create it. It has not been created under international law.
He has a great treatment in this one. In Obstacle to Peace, he talks about when the UN eventually recognized the state of Israel, and all the politics behind that too is in there. It's great. I learned so much already.
Yeah, it's all a very interesting story, and he's got it. He's got it down. He does very good work, and I like his stuff.
So a lot. Here's the thing: I don't want to make too much of this, but it seems like you might. I don't know what your opinion is or how seriously you take this kind of deal, because you know people say lots of things, but there's this quote from Netanyahu saying that the weak are slaughtered and the strong prevail, and all of this stuff. And it sounds to me, you know, pretty fascist and contrary to the whole post-Enlightenment era of the idea of the inalienable rights of man and that kind of crazy crap. So what do you think?
Well, and it's not the first time. I saw an earlier quote where he says something very similar. This was tied in by, I've been watching lectures by a very good, interesting person by the name of Rabbi Yaakov Shapiro in New York. He's in Queens, I think, or maybe Long Island. I'm not sure. And he's been speaking. He's got a new book out. It's like a 3-volume book called The Empty Wagon about how Zionism hijacked Judaism. He's an ultra-Orthodox Jew. So I don't agree with him on theology and religion. But he's extremely sharp. He's kind of a young guy. He's maybe about 50. He's not like one of the sort of real old rabbis you might think of when you think of ultra-Orthodox, you know, long beard and all that. Now his dress is more modern, and he's very culturally tuned in. When he talks, he's got lots of, you know, just very current cultural references. He doesn't live in isolation or anything like that. He's a really cool guy. And his analysis is impeccable about how the Zionists – did not like, see, this is a point I've made before, and many have made it before. You know, the term self-hating Jew gets thrown around, normally at some, you know, a Jewish person or a person who might have had a Jewish upbringing but may not consider himself Jewish, who criticizes Israel. They didn't want to call him an anti-Semite, right, the pro-Israel people.
Pretty hard to do that to a rabbi, though, right?
So you call him a self-hating Jew. Well, it is. But what he points out, and again, others have done this, and he's got the quotes from Herzl and Jabotinsky and Ben-Gurion and a lot of other top-ranking people who were pushing the formation of the state, they are the original self-hating Jews. They did not like the Eastern religious Jews, you know, the people who were just emerging in the late 19th century from ghetto, because there was a process of emancipation after Napoleon or with Napoleon and then beyond. So these self-contained, self-governing ghettos, which had some autonomy from the czar or from, you know, the central government, were coming into the modern world. And they, the Zionists, who were by and large atheists and totally assimilated, didn't practice Judaism, they did not like, you know, quote, the, you know, the, sort of the old Jew. And they also didn't like the rest of the, like the German Jews, the ones who had integrated themselves into society, because they saw them as subservient and weak. They didn't fight because they wanted to get along with their societies, and they didn't, they didn't press things. They were doing what they thought God told them to do, namely, you live at peace in whatever society you're in. Herzl and his guys were promising to create a new Jew. And I don't exaggerate. You can look this up. You can go. You can watch the lectures by Shapiro, or you can just find the quotations from Herzl. Or you can find his diary online. Read the stuff. They needed to create a new Jew because the old Jew they thought was disgusting, and they used terms like that: revolting, repulsive. They even say things like, "The anti-Semites are right to hate them. Look at them. They're diseased. They're unhealthy. They're passive." Yeah, because the Orthodox, of course, when they were Orthodox, there was only Orthodox in Eastern Europe and further east, they weren't interested in the outer society. They believed their duty was to read the holy books, right, and study the Torah and the Talmud and the oral law, and that's what they spent their time doing. My grandfather, who was some strain of Orthodox, there are actually several strains. My Lithuanian paternal grandfather. That's what he spent most of his time doing, reading the commentaries, the great rabbis of the Middle Ages who were interpreting the oral law, who were interpreting the written law. That's what they spent their time doing. They thought that was what God wanted them to do. Herzl and the secular Zionists sneered at that and said, okay, we need to break free of this. And that's why they wanted to set up a new state, a new country. We're going to be like regular people. We're going to farm. We're going to be strong. So that comes out of that because, you know, Jabotinsky is one of these. And the Likud party is inspired by Jabotinsky, the revisionists they were known as. And the Netanyahus were inspired by Jabotinsky, his father and now the son, Bibi. So that comes out of that. That's right. We have to show we're strong. And, you know, he pointed out, Shapiro pointed out a couple of years ago when the UN had passed a resolution against the settlements in the West Bank. And there was Jewish criticism of Israel in connection with this for the settlements, you know, the sort of liberal Jews and non-Zionist Jews who say the settlements are destructive and violations of international law. Netanyahu, who was prime minister at the time, said something like, that's the diaspora mentality, enough of the diaspora mentality bowing and scraping, you know, to the societies you live in. We're strong. We're healthy. No, he didn't defend the settlements. He didn't say we need them or they don't violate international law or who cares if they violate. He said nothing like that. He said his only answer was, we are a strong people. We are a healthy nation. Enough of this diaspora mentality. So this is not new for him. And you're right. There's something extremely unattractive about it.
Yeah, well, hey, it's tribalism. I think we may have talked before about this Mike Wallace interview I saw years ago with Rabbi Kahane, who, you know, he was the first Al-Qaeda attack in America, was Egyptian Islamic Jihad assassinated him in New York City in 1990. And but his party had been banned by the Supreme Court of Israel for being fascists, and they wanted to just finish the Nakba and kick the rest of the Palestinians out of the West Bank entirely, I guess, and this kind of thing. But so Mike Wallace interviewed him, and he specifically said, listen, you believe in Thomas Jefferson and all this stuff about the unalienable rights of man. I don't believe in that. I only believe in my tribe, and it's okay to murder anybody in our way, and we win and you lose, and that's it. I'm paraphrasing roughly, but not very. And that was it. And he was just saying, we have a fundamental disagreement here. See, I don't believe in the Declaration of Independence. You do. So shrug.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's right.
Which is kind of a pretty big point, you know, when in fact, the whole propaganda here is that Israel is like an American fort out on our eastern frontier somehow, you know, spreading Western Enlightenment policy and this and that, when really, yeah, it's not so much that way.
Well, Kahane was at least, you can say this in his on his behalf, he was refreshingly honest instead of trying to couch it in sort of American terms, traditional American terms, and confusing people, saying, well, I don't quite see the connection. You know,
and I don't think his party would be banned these days. I don't know why it would.
His attitude, well, right. Well, I mean, I think some of his, some of those types of Zionists are probably in the party. You know, as we know, the Likud is not the rightmost party anymore. It might have been at one time, but we have Avigdor Lieberman and others that go beyond that. And we have the Minister of Justice, what's the name, Shockhead, saying things like, we got to kill the Palestinian mothers because they give birth to snakes, and, you know, stuff like that. I mean, that sounds like the spirit of Kahane if I ever heard it.
Yeah. And that's their attorney general, their justice minister.
She says that in public.
Yeah.
Ayelet Shockhead. You can look it up.
The Scott Horton Show is brought to you by books, particularly Kesslyn Runs, a new dystopian novel about the very near future by the great Charles Featherstone. Kesslyn Runs. Also, No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. And The War State by Mike Swanson, about the rise of the military-industrial complex in America after World War II. He also gives great investment advice at WallStreetWindow.com. And when you follow his advice, you'll want to get some precious metals, gold and silver and et cetera, from Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. That's at rrbi.co, rrbi.co. Also, check out Zencash at zencash.com or zensystem.io. It's a great digital currency, but it's also a messaging app and a document transfer app and all kinds of great stuff, too. Learn all about it at zencash.com. And then there's Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom. If you sign up from the link on my page at scotthorton.org, I'll get a little bit of a kickback there. And check this out. Speaking of ScottHorton.org, if you'd like expanddesigns.com to build you a new 2018 model website, go to expanddesigns.com/Scott and you'll save $500. Also, don't forget the bumpersticker.com. Stickers for your band or your business at very reasonable prices. High quality stuff there. It used to be my company back when. Thebumpersticker.com. Wrote it on Facebook.
Yeah. It's not a secret.
So now listen, I don't know, you may remember this, but MJ Rosenberg back years ago, he wrote this thing, and unfortunately it was at Media Matters, and they purged him because he used the term Israel first, and which I guess made MJ Rosenberg a right-wing racist for a minute or something. So, you know, they erased his archive, unfortunately, because there was this great article where he went through step by step and, you know, explained how if the Israelis had only played it cool and confident at this point and this point and this point and this point, if they'd only listened to the doves at these periods of crisis, then things would really be, they would have a pretty adequate status quo over there. Things would be fine. You could have independence for the Palestinians and peace, and things would be all right. And how the Hawks just always won out, which, you know, Ramsey Baruch had a great point about that, that, well, I guess that's what Zionism is then. You know, but if you, like, for example, Yuri Avnery just died, and, you know, if you've spent a lot of time reading his archives, as I have, over the years, you could really see how it didn't have to be this way, where, you know, even accepting the Nakba just as a fait accompli, that they could have got along. I mean, that was basically Yuri Avnery's thing. He fought in the 48 war, but then he almost immediately said that there should be a Palestinian state and independence for these people too, and we got to be good sports about this and good winners about it, and not continue to oppress them and all that kind of thing. And so you could certainly see how that whole, you know, right-wing Netanyahu take about strength and all that has been so counterproductive ultimately, and has led to Israel being, you know, this completely perversely right wing society, and in a very American way, their economy completely distorted toward war, their entire population, you know, conscripts at one time or another. This little socialist Sparta over there, as Raimondo called it years ago. And they're, you know, they're always in a state of conflict. And
look, you had certain people in the late 40s before up to the founding of Israel and then beyond it too. Judah Magnus, who was a founder and chancellor of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and a man who went by the pen name Ahad Ha'am, Martin Buber, who all said we should not be hostile to the Arabs. We should not be, if we're going to come here, we should not come here as their enemies or their adversaries. They would get dismissed as traitors or fools or ignorant. And I heard in one of these lectures, I heard someone mentioning that there was a dialogue between Chaim Weizmann, who was the first president of Israel, and one of the chief organizers of the Zionist movement as it headed toward the foundation of Israel. He lived in Britain. He had moved from, you know, Europe, Eastern Europe, to Britain at one point, and was there for quite a while, and was the leading Zionist in England. He had an encounter with Gandhi at one point, and Gandhi says to him, things would have been so different if you had simply said to the Arabs, you know, especially after Hitler, it didn't take Hitler. You had a terrible history in Europe of treatment to Jews, of Jews. Gandhi said, if you had just said to the, you know, to the sort of Arab, influential Arabs in Palestine, can we come here and make a sanctuary, an asylum, not a religious sanctuary, but I mean, a safe haven. He said things would have been extremely different because there was a long history of Jews and Muslims, Arabs, and Persians, Iranians living, you know, reasonably peaceful. Nothing's ever perfect. I don't want to say it was paradise, but there weren't pogroms or anything of that nature. There certainly wasn't a Holocaust. And so Gandhi is telling him, you know, things would have been so different if you had taken that tack. Instead, the Zionist movement said, hey, we're coming to reclaim our land from 2,000 years ago, so get out. That's not the way you win friends and influence people, to use Dale Carnegie's old book title. But they didn't want to just live. They didn't want to just coexist. I mean, the people that actually wanted to organize a state. And this is where Rabbi Shapiro's analysis is so good, because he says that's because they didn't want. It wasn't, the whole idea was not a safe haven for the displaced Jews or the oppressed Jews. That wasn't the point. That would have been a rather modest ambition. What they wanted to do was change Jewishness totally by turning it into a political ideology and a nationalism and a statehood, a state, a nation state. And Shapiro says that's not Judaism. That was a revolt against Judaism. I think his analysis is very good. I mean, he's of this group called True Torah Jews. You can look them up. They have a website, and they have lots of YouTube lectures. His analysis is, you know,
second. I guess, you know, that's sort of interesting to me, but it's also kind of none of my business. You know what I mean? I look at it more about, you know, that's like somebody else's inside baseball game, whereas...
Well, I'll tell you why it's not. Look, most of the attention to Israel's conduct from the start has been on, you know, and it's certainly, I'm not saying it got too much attention. It didn't. On the internal victims, right? The victims within Palestine, namely the Arab Muslims and Christians. But this, and he's sympathetic to them, of course. But he's rounding out the analysis by showing there are other victims too. Now, they're not in the same way, victims getting kicked off land or killed or, you know, stuff like that. But they're still victims of this whole movement because, number one, he says it was identity theft, right? They stole their religion, and he makes an interesting point there. But he says it also, and this was warned from the very beginning, it jeopardizes Jews who live in other countries and who regard themselves happily, proudly even, as citizens of America or Britain or Canada or Australia, wherever they live, even, you know, Germany. There's lots of Jews have moved from Israel to Berlin in recent years. And he says they're jeopardized too, because here you got Netanyahu saying, especially in light of this nation state law that they passed recently, I am the prime minister, not just of the citizens, not even just the Jewish citizens of Israel, but all Jews everywhere. No matter when they were, where they were born, whether they ever have been to Israel, whether they have an intention of going to Israel, all they need to be is that they have a Jewish mother or they've been converted by an approved rabbi. I am your prime minister. And he says, look, I can't escape that. He said, if I don't want Trump to be my president, I can move to Canada or I can move, you know, to anywhere else and become a citizen of that country. Trump's no longer my president. I can't escape Netanyahu. And I think that – I don't think that's just inside baseball or someone else's fight. That just shows you the presumption.
Well, it's patently absurd though, right, that Jews are all connected through time and space and to somehow being what, represented? I mean, what does that even mean, right? It's not like he has judicial power over Jews in other countries or
But look what Netanyahu –
doesn't even mean it. It's just a bunch of sloganeering and propaganda is all it means, really, right?
Look what Netanyahu and his lieutenants do, and they've done this over the last couple of years. They've gone into countries like France and even the United States and said to Jews, you're not safe. You know, any incident which can be interpreted as an anti-Semitic incident, they seize on.
Yeah.
Even if it's purely a complaint against Israel, not Jews, they'll say, see, you're not safe. That's why Israel's here. Come to Israel. Aliyah, right? They bring young people on these birthright trips. Americans for free, young Americans for free. Of course, a lot of them are upset that they don't get told the whole story and they break away and go to the West Bank and told, don't go to the West Bank, you'll be killed and raped. Of course, they're not killed and raped. Yeah. They actually learn. But that, so it doesn't leave American Jews untouched. And I don't think it is just inside baseball.
No, you're right. But I guess, but back to the point of, you know, this Netanyahu's rant about the strong survive and all of that. It seems like the strong dig deeper graves for themselves is really more like it. And so that, right, like, okay, so if I didn't care at all about the Palestinians or any of this stuff, and I was just trying to, like, I just got here, I'm Kang and Kodos in outer space looking down or whatever. It seems like the Israelis have a policy that is very short term in nature, where they've created this apartheid system that, you know, even in the words of Ehud Barak, the former prime minister who made it this way, who helped, and also he was a defense minister under Netanyahu in Netanyahu's first government. His first government this time around. I mean, he was prime minister before. But anyway, Ehud Barak has said, boy, you know, if we really solidify this whole apartheid system thing, then that means that the clock is ticking on our sorry asses, because we can't do that under the... If we just ignore, as so many people do, if we just ignore the occupation and just set that aside, then they have a 80-20 super-duper majority Jewish population inside Israel over the 20% Palestinian Christians and Arabs. And so that is, you know, not that it's based on justice or anything like that, the way it got that way, but that much is at least sustainable. But permanently occupying an equal number of completely rightsless Palestinian helots in the territories is just, it's untenable. You know, it may last another decade or more, as far as I know, but it's not going to last the century.
Well, and a lot of people in the power structure of Israel in 67, like including Ben-Gurion, who was retired by this point, saw that problem and was saying we can't keep the territories for that very reason. You know, maybe someday they thought they'd hope to maybe take them back under different circumstances. But he realized that if you acquire a territory that includes so many Palestinians, Arabs, that you're going to face this issue. And others warned, even inside the cabinet, warned that it's not sustainable, just as you say. But the others... And a lot of people just thought for that reason it won't last. Israel will take up, UN Resolution 242 and talk land for peace. But it didn't happen, because we're now in, 51 years? And no sign of an ending. In fact, if all the signs go the other way, that there's no intention of giving up any territory to the Palestinians, or returning, I should say, returning territory.
Yeah, ceasing to take. Yeah,
I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I don't envision. I can't see the future at all, because every alternative seems impossible. So I do not know what's.
At some point, I mean, there's going to come a crisis where people are going to wish they'd listened to Yuri Avnery all along, and that's the whole thing about it, right? Is it's not like they were just warned by, you know, American libertarian writers or something like that, which they were. Mm-hmm. Rothbard was, people want to read about the 67 war, read Rothbard from 1967 on it, you know. But it's not just that. It's that they had people like Yuri Avnery, who was right there, you know, was an equal peer with all of the most famous names of Israeli politics since 1948, this entire time, and called them by their first name and told this stuff to them right to their face and made them admit that he was right, and then they ignored him anyway. And I mean, it's all there in those archives too. He tells all those stories, and you know, I think he's not a living, I was gonna say he's a great living example. He very recently was a living example of how it just didn't have to be this way, but they're certainly on the road to self-destruction now, one way or another.
There were many, many warnings, you know, from the inside, so to speak. Plenty of people who said this is not going to work. I mean, you can go back and read the criticisms or the warnings of Rabbi Elmer Berger, who was one of the founders of the American Council for Judaism in 1942, warning about this.
Now, yeah, he was a book about him.
Well, Jack Rawls, very good biography of him and the whole Jewish American Jewish anti-Zionist movement called Rabbi Outcast. And there was a whole.
What's the author of that's name? I'm sorry, I should mention him, because I promise.
That's Jack Ross's book.
That's right. Sorry, Jack. I'm going to get to it someday, man. If you're out there.
And he's not the only. You know, Berger wasn't the only one. I knew Berger. He died in the late 90s, but I knew him. Alfred Lilienthal was another one who was involved in the council for a while, and then his own newsletter for many years. These were American Jews who, number one, had the same concerns that I just attributed to Rabbi Shapiro. They said, wait a second, we're Americans. Don't tell me this state you guys want to set up is my nation state. So they object. They would have objected to Israel even if Palestine really had been a land without a people. You know, it's not only that they took other people's land. That's obviously very serious, and that was one of the major complaints, one of the major cases against it. But it was not the only one for American Reformed Jews and Orthodox Jews. If it had truly been vacant, if it had been another planet where there was not another person, and Herzl said, we're going to set up the state of the, for the Jewish people, of the Jewish people, on this totally vacant planet, they would have objected, saying, no, Judaism is not a political movement. It's a religious community made up of many nationals, different kinds of nationals, ethnicities, races. There's black Jews, there's Chinese Jews, there's Indian Jews. It's not a single entity of any kind except religious community. That's the only thing they have in common. And so they would object it even if there had been no, you know, land victims or victims in the sense that the Palestinians are, have been victims. Mm-hmm. And I think that's interesting to keep in mind. I mean, it's two parts of it's a two part story, and the American Reform and Orthodox, but the Reform were very sophisticated in presenting their case. They didn't get listened to. They got smeared. They got smeared by the what were known as pretty much the conservative Jewish movement in the United States, which was pro Zionist, especially after World War II, and. Because then, after World War II, it could then be portrayed as a humanitarian refugee project, right? That you have the displaced Jews of Europe who need a place to go. So for a lot of people who were ambivalent about it or maybe didn't like it before the war, now they could say, well, okay, yeah, come on. You have all these displaced people. We better be for it. So a lot of people went over to the Zionist side, who had been anti-Zionist or non-Zionist, because it took on the cover of a purely like rescue effort. But it was not intended to be a rescue effort. All Jews were supposed to move, whether they were living fine and peacefully in the United States or whether they were, you know, living under the Tsar, and you know, their life was like a fiddler on the roof, to use a well-known phrase. It didn't matter. For the Zionists, that was going to be the Jewish state, not in the sense it was going to be a religious state, but it was going to be the place where the Jews were. And that's what they wanted to do. Now, they were willing to have some stay behind because to raise money and stuff like that and be their advocates. So, you know, they weren't demanding 100% attendance. But that was supposed to be, you know, the state. If you were Jewish, that was your state. And that's what raised the whole dual loyalty problem, which many Jews suffered under because they were viewed with suspicion, and which makes Rabbi Shapiro's case that Zionism breeds anti-Semitism. And I think he makes a very strong case for that. It does. And as Israel is seen to be creating more and more problems which implicate the United States, I fear, as he does, that that will be taken out on, you know, Jews indiscriminately, which would be a terrible thing by the perpetrators. I mean, they should know that Jewish doesn't mean pro-Israel, because there are plenty of Jews who don't like Israel or what it's up to. But that wouldn't relieve responsibility of everyone who tries to teach everybody else that, no, it is the state of the Jewish people, all Jewish people, and that there's no distinction between Judaism and Zionism. Shapiro points out the following. David Duke has condemned Rabbi Shapiro for saying that Judaism is not Zionism, that they're different, that they're not only different, they're opposites. He's condemned them because Duke and his people have a stake in saying they're the same. That's very dangerous to American Jews, to French Jews, to English, you know, British Jews, Jews everywhere outside of Israel, and in Israel too. And this makes Rabbi Shapiro very concerned. He's trying to tell the, you know, just the average person, there's a distinction here.
Mm-hmm. All right, you guys, here's how to support this show. First of all, subscribe to the RSS feeds, iTunes, Stitcher, and all of that. All the feeds are available at scotthorton.org and also at libertarianinstitute.org. You can also follow me on youtube.com/ScottHortonShow. And sign up for Patreon. If you do, anybody who signs up for $1 per interview gets 2 free books from Listen and Think Audio. And also you'll get keys to the new Reddit page, Reddit patreon.com/Scott Horton Show. And then if you go to scotthorton.org/donate, $20 will get you the audiobook of Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. $50 will get you a signed copy of the paperback there. And a $100 donation will get you either a QR code, commodity disc, or a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think Libertarian audiobooks. That's all at scotthorton.org/donate. And also anybody donating $5 or more per month there, if you already are or if you sign up now, you'll get keys to that new Reddit group as well. Already got about 50 people in there and it's turning out pretty good. Again, that's reddit.com/Scott Horton Show. If you're already donating or you're a new donor, just email me scott@scotthorton.org and I'll get you the keys there. And hey, do me a favor, give me a good review on iTunes or Stitcher, or if you liked the book on Amazon.com, and the audiobook is also on iTunes, and I sure would appreciate that. And listen, if you want to submit articles to the Libertarian Institute, please do, and they don't have to be about foreign policy. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Well, and of course, the neoconservatives, who are the most powerful, you know, agitating force of the Zionist movement and the Israel lobby in the United States, are certainly one of the most powerful factions that pushed for Iraq War II, and were basically the only ones who've been pushing for intervention in Syria since 2011 in this way, and constantly, you know, hawking it up against Iran and opposing the Iran nuclear deal and all these things. And all in the name of Zion, you know, unapologetically, that's it, you know, for them. As Wilkerson said on the show, did you hear that? Did they publish that one yet? Where Wilkerson says that Colin Powell told George Bush to his face, you know, the number three guy at the Pentagon is a card carrying member of the Likud party. And Bush said, you mean really? Like if I took his wallet, he's got the card in there? Talk about look, Douglas this- Feith, that is.
Yeah, no. This is you know, we're going to mention Shapiro again because I think it's very important. This does present a danger to American Jews and again Jews outside of Israel, because there are, you know, sort of crazy people out there who won't make the distinction, and if any event that could be, or any incident that could be interpreted as anti-Semitic, is then seized on by when it may only be anti-Israel. And I don't mean attacking people. There's obviously no excuse for that on any grounds. But Israel and its partisans will seize on that and say, see, we were right all along, not realizing that, or not, they maybe do realize it, but the other people won't realize that they're only right because they helped us to fan those flames. And then when they fan the flames and the fire flares up, they then say, see, we told you.
Yeah.
We told you there was a fire.
Well, now, so by the way,
yeah, they were fanning the flames.
Now, under the new regime, would you just be banned from giving a talk like this on a college campus?
I don't know if it'd be banned. If a student felt I was creating a hostile atmosphere, he could make a complaint to the OCR, the Office of Civil Rights.
But even though really the gist of your entire thing is to discriminate and to make all of these distinctions and nuances and explain how these things are all not the same.
Well, don't forget, they only say you may be an anti-Semite, just like Jeff Foxworthy says, you may be a redneck. But of course, we know what the subtext is. You are a redneck, and yes, you are an anti-Semite.
You're guilty, and you have to prove yourself innocent, which you can't. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, and so the idea is to get people not to say it in the first place, right? In other words, to keep someone from saying what I'm saying on campus because, oh my gosh, a complaint might be filed, and then I'm going to be smeared, and maybe there's going to be some disciplinary action. So the idea is it's a preemptive strike to stop it from happening, not really to act afterwards. You don't want to have to act afterwards. Keep it from happening in the first place. That's
you know
the
what?
Point.
To me, it smacks of whining when you're not allowed to say this or that. I mean, give me a break. We call them kids, but they're really, you know, they've graduated from high school. They're over 18. They ought to be able to take it.
This comes from the right, as we know. David Horowitz.
Yeah, exactly. They need a safe space for their little crybaby social justice thing on behalf of Israel.
They're the ones who sneer at the snowflakes, right? When it's when it's people on the left, students on the left, and they're the ones who you know, complain about the lack of free speech on campus when people on the left are saying it.
And what's hilarious is both sides will call each other out on their hypocrisy and double down on their own rather than ever stopping and taking the other guy's side for a minute and saying, you know what, I'll defend your right even though I disagree with you, which would and be so the classy the thing right to do.
The right hates political correctness, but the original political correctness, before that was even a term, was regarding Israel. Right, you couldn't criticize Israel. I'm going. I'm talking about the the late 40s and the 50s and beyond. That's what you couldn't say in polite company. Why? Because you must be anti-Semitic. That was the original political correctness.
And all right, now
it came from that side of the spectrum.
The bigger question is, why do any of these neocons hate and fear Donald Trump? Did they really think that he was going to be anti-Israel in any way? Because one time he mumbled something about some fairness that was never going to be implemented in any way. Give me a break. I mean, they panicked over him worse than they panicked over Obama.
Yeah, I don't know if it had to do just with his own, you know, personal history, and they didn't have confidence in him or what he was saying.
He was kind of rude to AIPAC. He said, "I don't need you," and all this stuff at AIPAC. But come on,
that was before he went to their meeting right after Hillary or before Hillary, and gave a speech that Hillary could have given. They could have switched their speeches by accident. They would have noticed.
I mean, there are pictures of him like marching in a big Israel Day parade down the street in New York with a big sash like the mayor of Springfield on The Simpsons and a wand in his hand and stuff. I don't know if he has a wand.
He bragged about the award he got from the state of Israel during the campaign. So I think it had to do with other things. Maybe they just didn't think he was reliable. I mean, they had other people running, don't forget. So,
and he's also horrible on Iran. He was like, "Let me tell you how horrible I am on Iran. I'm the worst." That was his entire platform. Yeah, I don't know why that wasn't good enough for them. I really can't understand.
But I'm speculating here. When Trump first gets into it, they probably thought he didn't really have a shot anyway. And what do they need him for? They had Rubio.
They had Hillary.
So why would you go with him, who's a little bit, erratic and unpredictable? I can understand why at first they wouldn't have been for him. When National Review did that anti-Trump edition.
Yeah, and it's all about Russia in this case. Or not all, but...
Yeah, but it wasn't just that. Rich Lowry, I don't know if he's still the editor or was the editor at the time. His essay in that, and I think he wasn't the only one who said this, his essay in that was on immigration, Trump is too liberal. Because remember Trump used to say, and then this big, beautiful wall, there's going to be a big, beautiful door where people can come in, as he puts it, legally. He always has like L-E-E-E-E-G, legally. Yeah. Legally. They didn't want, and Rich Lowry said, "What's this business about a door on the wall?" He's a liberal. I'm not kidding. Go back and read that.
I would doubt it. Okay, so now that brings us, actually, that's a nice segue into today's article, because we've really been talking about other things.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Well, so today's article is, "Are We Sure It Can't Happen Here?" And it's about the demonization and persecution of American immigrants.
Well, I've been reading, and it took me too long to get to her work, and I have a long way to go, but I've been reading Hannah Arendt, who, of course, is famous for many books, The Origins of Totalitarianism, which she wrote in, published in 1951. And her book, when she covered the Eichmann trial in 62, 63, I guess, in Jerusalem, Eichmann in Jerusalem, A Report on the Banality of Evil, which got under a lot of trouble, but is still an influential book that's discussed to this day.
And coined that phrase, really. That's like a cliche, the banality of evil. Some bureaucrat with a clipboard killing somebody.
Well, yeah, I mean, I do get into that sort of thing in this piece. Her point there was, she believed, she was under the influence of Immanuel Kant when she wrote her Origins of Totalitarianism. She thought evil was radical in the sense it was profound. It went down deep to the roots of things. And that's what when she went to Jerusalem to see for the first time a Nazi sort of face-to-face, because she got out of Germany in 1933, just as Hitler is coming to power. She gets to France, then she's detained in France. She's in a detention camp facility for a while before she gets to the U.S. So she didn't live full-blown under the Nazis. It was too soon. She got out. So she wanted to go back. She asked the New Yorker, send me to Jerusalem. I want to cover the trial. So they sent her. And she wanted to see this face of evil, you know, up front, up close. And she was shocked as she watched Eichmann testify. And she also read the 3,500 pages of his police questioning, interrogation. They've done long, long interviews with him that were very revealing. And she read, you know, watched the testimony and then read the testimony. So she immersed herself in this. And she said, no, evil doesn't have deep roots, certainly not in the, at the level of Eichmann. It's banal. He just sees himself as following orders, doing what you do in this regime. The Führer's word is law. I'm a German. I'm a good civil servant. I also want to advance in my career. I want to succeed in this society. I then go ahead and do what I'm instructed to do. And a lot of people said, oh, well, how could you believe him? He was lying. You know, he claimed he wasn't an anti-Semite. And she believed him. She said, when you read all the testimony, he doesn't seem like an anti-Semite. The question would have been very interesting. He was asked during his testimony, if Hitler had told you to kill your father because he was a traitor, would you kill him? And he kind of weaseled. He said, well, if he showed me proof. And the prosecutor said, no, I'm not saying he shows you proof. He just says, kill him, he's a traitor. I think he ends up saying, yeah, I would. The question I think that should have been asked of Eichmann, and I don't believe it was, I didn't see any reference to it, is if Hitler one day said, hey, people, forget about the Jews. I got another problem there. Leave the Jews alone. What would his attitude have been? That's an interesting question, because it would be if he says, oh, yeah, then I switch to the new program, then Arendt is certainly right. I mean, he claimed he didn't hate Jews. He had a Jewish mistress when he was in Vienna arranging for the expulsion of Jews from Austria. The first part of his career was getting the Jews out of Germany and Austria. This as official, not this was not subterranean. This was official duties. And his whole orientation was transfer, or what we call expulsion. I mean, they didn't have any choice in that matter, but getting them out rather than killing them, which is certainly better if that's the choice. And he had read the Jewish state. He had read Herzl's book, and according to Arendt, became a lifelong Zionist, and worked with the Jewish leaders to facilitate the transfer. So it's all very interesting stuff. My point for the article is that the horror of Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia, because she's also talking about the Soviet Union, she's talking about totalitarianism, which she said was new in the 20th century. It was unlike previous despotisms and authoritarian systems. It's totally new. And it's a terror state. And in order to dominate people and create a terror state, you must dehumanize everybody, not just the targeted victims, but even by implication, everybody else. People are interchangeable. Nobody really knows who could get taken off to camps at any time, because it's not really tied to a crime or political resistance. I mean, the Jews that were taken away, they hadn't done anything. They were storekeepers and lawyers and doctors, and then they were kicked out of the professions and out of the universities. They hadn't done anything. And so I try to show that, I'm not predicting this for America, but I'm also not ruling it out. And it begins with dehumanization. And what we see in Trump's policy and speeches and his harangues at rallies, which are very scary, about refugees and about legal and illegal immigrants in the United States, is dehumanization. He doesn't ever talk as if they're persons, right? They're rapists. I mean, yeah, he'll once in a while, like when he first launched his campaign, he said, some are good people. You know, that's like a throwaway. Some are good people, and he never says anything like that again. They're rapists, and they're bringing drugs and all that stuff. And then anytime there's a crime committed by, say, an illegal, allegedly, I don't know if these cases have been proven, but even though we know that immigrants, legal and illegal, are much less represented among the ranks of criminals, plenty of studies show that, he'll make it out to be, no, this is an existential threat to the United States, that they're criminals, they're murdering our people, and even the ones who haven't murdered anybody yet, well, they're just, you know, waiting to murder. That's the whole attitude. He's dehumanizing them. And I wanted to tie that into Arendt's warning that dehumanization is kind of the first step to horrible things. And to put this in my words, these aren't her words, if we want to make sure that kind of horror and ultimately genocide can't occur, we need to promote the virtues of individualism and pluralism. In other words, freedom, because that's our insurance policy against these horrors that we saw in Soviet Union and in Germany and, you know, in so many other places, Cambodia, you can name, we can China, Mao's China, we can name other examples. We need to make sure, we need to fight the humanization at the earliest stage, which means we need to be fighting it already. Because if it proceeds down that road, you know, things are out of control. You got to stop it now. You need to stop it through public campaigns, writing, speaking, you know, doing what our institute tries to do. Teach people to love the rights, human rights, individual rights, and pluralism. We have to really stress that, pluralism, because there are people who fear pluralism, right? It's a threat to our culture. You hear it on the alt right, and you hear it from Trump. There's a threat to our culture. Are nice, as if there's some homogeneous culture. It's nonsense. There's no homogeneous culture anywhere, except maybe some, you know, isolated group somewhere that's not encountered modern civilization, and I don't know how many of those are left. There's no such thing. But the Bannon types, you know, the Stephen Miller types, we need to fight that, because great danger lies ahead if it becomes like a snowball going down a hill, right? And then it becomes an avalanche. It's too late once we notice it's an avalanche. You got to fight it now. And that's what I tried to warn about in the piece. Mm-hmm.
Now, and so the thing is, you might sound a little bit alarmist, but I think this is something I always feel like complaining about, and you've given me a great opportunity to hear about the worst kind of perverse interpretations of World War II, where everybody talks about all the lessons and all of this, but then really the lesson that's come out of it is anything less than World War II is fine. And so, you know, for example, you can't criticize the Israelis treating the people of Gaza like they live in the Warsaw Ghetto, because then you're calling the Likud the SS, and that is moral equivalence, and that is wrong, and that is out of proportion, and I don't see a complete and total Holocaust going on in Palestine, so therefore any comparison is unfair. When the whole point supposedly was, hey, man, anything that smacks of National Socialism at all, we need to all be very aware of and wary of. And that includes your National Highway Project. That includes everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's like that, the name of that program at Rutgers that got into the trouble. Never Again for Anybody, it's called. It's like sort of like Black Lives Matter, all lives matter. This is
so maybe
never
you
again.
Know Trump probably. I don't think you're saying that Trump is going to round up and start shooting all the Mexicans in the head. You're just saying, hey, let's not go down that road at all, because our society ain't very libertarian right now. Speaking of our culture, and we're trying to make it more libertarian, not less. So how about that? You know, let's, as you're saying, emphasize pluralism, tolerance for other people. And that's supposed to be what makes us so advanced as libertarians, especially, is that, yeah, no, really, not just freedom for me, but freedom for you, too. And I don't know what you're going to do with it, but I ain't afraid. Go ahead. It should be fine.
Where
most people don't really think that way. Most people just think, well, my way or the highway, and everybody else, you know, who knows what they might do if they were free.
What I'm saying is, if we don't want to go down a road that will horrify us, we have to fight dehumanization and not let the attitude catch on that, oh, well, that group of people, they're superfluous. That's another word out of Aaron. They're superfluous. It doesn't really matter. You know, as I say in the article, if a local child protective services takes a child from a family because of, you know, some stupid thing the family's alleged to have done or didn't do, the right will scream about that. Properly, we'll scream about that. That's terrible. What a disproportionate measure, taking the child away for whatever the little violation is. On the other hand, when the child's taken away from a Central American, someone who's come in seeking refuge from, you know, great violence and tyranny, they're satisfied with saying it's the law. That's the banality of evil, I think. It's because they don't regard them as persons, because the officials don't regard them as persons. So we have to fight this attitude. We don't want this attitude to catch on that a group of people, any group of people, is superfluous and basically non-persons. Because if it starts with one group, you don't know where that's going to spread. It's kind of like a wildfire. Maybe it's going to spread to some American citizens. Look what they're doing. They're going after people who appear to be American citizens, living near the border on the grounds that, well, we suspect they only were recognized as citizens as babies because of fraudulent documents. They haven't proved it in any particular case. They're just saying, and they're going after people on the grounds that we don't think you're really a citizen. We think you only got those papers when you were a baby. The hospital, they were issued only because there were some fraudulent papers. Or the case of the Dreamers, right? These adults now who came as children, didn't choose to come here, but came as children. It's the only society they know. They're living perfectly peaceful lives, responsible lives, have families and everything, married to American citizens in some cases. They live with a threat of getting kicked out. They're non-persons. If you treat them that way, you're saying you're not really a person. And we don't want this idea instilled in Americans that, you know, living among us are non-persons. This is a potentially very dangerous thing. And I'm not saying it's inevitable that the nightmare can occur, but the nightmare can't occur if this sort of attitude is not widespread, if it's just confined to the fringes. Or if it doesn't exist at all, mm-hmm. that sort of closes off the chance of the nightmare. That's why I say love of rights and freedom and pluralism, and I throw the case for free markets in there because it's necessary. If people are economically insecure because of recession, depression, chronic unemployment, which the government causes, that fans the flames of bigotry. We know that. If people are wondering, can't find work, they look for scapegoats. I mean, it helps to promote that bad stuff. So part of the insurance policy is a truly free society and a freed market, not what people think is a free market today, but a truly free market. And so that's what creates economic security. And when people are economically secure, they're, you know, it's not impossible, but they're less likely to eye with suspicion, you know, oh, maybe that guy's taking the job I would have had or something like that. We gotta stomp out, and I don't mean this in any violent physical way, but metaphorically, stomp out the seeds of this intolerance, which leads to dehumanization, which can lead to the nightmare, as I call it.
Yeah. Well, you know what, man? This all goes to the guilt of the liberal class, of the, not the libertarians, but the moderates, the centrists. Those who, you know, we see line up to worship McCain, who talks a lot like you, you know, that there are these values that we should have, like freedom and stuff like that, that are more important than just me, me, me. And you gotta, you know, care about the good of other people. And yet, then he's the perfect representation, isn't he, in his life and his death, of the corruption of liberalism, you know, where if, you know, mm-hmm. if Rothbard is libertarianism, then Thomas Friedman is liberalism, where, as he says, you have to have this mailed fist to back up the free market so that we can make all these gains for liberalism and democracy. And so what do we get? We get empire. We get millions of people killed. We get, of course, Zionism. We get the boom bust cycle that, you know, discredits the free market and empowers the state, and then ends up making libertarianism look bad. You know, it's like the funhouse mirror version of what you're talking about. And so then, you know, they run it into the ground, basically. Self-government and private property, well, that's the philosophy of the American totalitarians. And look at all the damage that they cause in the name of their sacred profits, et cetera, right? And, you know, discredit us. I was talking about being Kang and Kodos and just getting here and how short-term Israel's policy seems to be. Same thing for the Americans, too. They don't seem to be looking for the survival of our society over the long term in any way. Not the people in charge, I mean.
No, I agree. I think you have that just right. And it's always easy to blame, you know, the blameless.
Yeah. So and then I guess what I meant to say, too, was so then people, of course, some people become more and more libertarian as they figure it out, but a lot more people become more and more right wing and more left wing, and then therefore dehumanize each other more and more. Now it's not liberals fighting conservatives. Now it's commies and fascists who absolutely hate each other. And not that they really are commies and fascists necessarily, but that's what they call each other, you know. And so demonizing immigrants is one thing, but just everybody hating each other beyond the point of believing that they can even talk with each other and negotiate any of these things politically at all is that's a pretty dangerous slope that we're on, too.
I agree.
I guess I could have edited out a lot of what I said and just said that. But anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what else to add to that. I think you're absolutely right. And we have to be, kind of on edge and just be ready. And not just be ready. I mean, we need to be proactive and do stuff and have, you know, programs. I mean, the Libertarian Institute's an example of it. But we need to have programs that are publicizing this idea so that at least some people will encounter, you know, something else from what they're just seeing coming from, you know, their so-called leaders. I don't know what else to do exactly, but got to do something.
Yeah. All right. Well,
things get out of hand. We shouldn't just be rest. We shouldn't rest, as I say in the piece, we shouldn't just rest comfortably knowing, well, don't worry, the ACLU will jump in. I mean, they, you know, they will in a lot of cases. And it's great that they and other groups are ready to go after any, you know, particular outrage. But it's not enough. And there are still, you know, traditional protections of Anglo-American law that, you know, it's at least some minimal protection. But that's what I say in the piece is that that's not enough. We can't rest assured just with that. We need to go beyond that and actually fight the attitude, not wait for something to happen.
Yeah. Reed Richmond.
Yeah, it's possible.
Reed Richmond, TGIF, the goal is freedom. Every Friday at the Libertarian Institute. Thanks very much for your time again, Sheldon. Appreciate it.
I enjoyed it, Scott. Thank you.
All right, you guys. Are we sure it can't happen here? That's one. And before that, and this was the subject of much of our discussion here, anti-Israelism and anti-Semitism, the invidious conflation. Both of those at libertarianinstitute.org. All right, y'all, thanks. Find me at libertarianinstitute.org, at scotthorton.org, antiwar.com, and reddit.com/scotthortonshow. Oh, yeah, and read my book, Fool's Errand, Timed and the War in Afghanistan, at foolserrand.us.